Welcome to Mentoring Moments. Mentoring Moments is a sub-series of the E-Commerce Edge podcast. It is composed of clips taken from Jason's one-to-one and group mentorship sessions. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome Caleb Ufton from E-Commerce Wizards to the pod. Welcome, Caleb.
Hi, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
We were joking off air about your awesome freaking hair. I said to you that you're like, for people that aren't watching the video, that your hair is so badass. It's got this. It reminds me of Dr. Emmett Brown from Back to the Future. That's who it reminds me of. But what I said is that I would, even if I didn't know what industry you were in, I would have assumed that you were in the creative industry of some variety because your hair is so wild and cool.
Yeah, I actually, when I was going through several years ago, when I was just learning conversion optimization, I had this phase where I was like trying to brand myself as Dr. Data. It didn't really go anywhere, but I had this awesome caricature done and I had exactly that kind of hair. It was like, yeah, go all in on the mad scientist. And I've just never looked back, to be honest. I surf, I get a lot of sun. So a lot of people just assume it's surfer hair, but if you go to a networking event, like a LinkedIn local or something, people are like, that guy's a marketer.
Yeah, he works in the creative space. I just knew it for sure. No, this is cool. And it's awesome to have you along for the ride today as a Kiwi now living in Australia, which I think you mentioned something like 250,000 Kiwis or something like that, or a quarter of Kiwis or something like that live overseas. I have had Kiwis. Yeah. I think you're the fourth or fifth Kiwi I've had on the pod, but most of them actually don't live in New Zealand anymore.
Yeah, I think the stats when I stat that I quoted was 25% of Kiwis. So I think the population is somewhere between 5 and 6 million at the moment, and a good middle and a half, I think, live outside the country. So it's somewhere between sort of 20 to 25% don't live in the country. We're spread out all around the world.
Yeah, I've met Kiwis in almost every country that I've been to, but they definitely are really heavily concentrated in Australia, the UK, a few in the US and other countries as well. And I've met a few here in Mexico as well. So definitely, they say Kiwis can't fly, but in my experience, they definitely do.
Yeah, we find a way.
And look, Caleb. Yeah, exactly. Or Air New Zealand or one of those other ones. But it is great to have you along for the ride today. And I wanted to get you on as a bit of a guest mentor because you're working in a space with finishing up with Echo, which is your marketing agency, and now getting into E-Commerce Wizards, specializing in CRO and a few other things. But really, I think you bring together some really interesting interests on your side around psychology, mindset, heartset, tactics, overall strategies, marketing strategies, conversion rate optimization strategies. You've got a very eclectic background, and you're a web developer for Food Matters. It's working in a space that's near and dear to my heart with health, nutrition, mindset, those types of things. I worked at HealthPost for a number of years and New Zealand's largest online retailer of natural health products. You're an eclectic mix, man.
Yeah, that's something else I get. I've fixed my first computer when I was 5 years old, which I'd broken about half an hour before. It was my dad's $5,000 486 SX25. And I was like, oh shit, it's not booting into Windows. What have I done? Oh yeah, how explicit should I be?
go for your life. It's fine.
Go for gold. Cool. Yeah. So that was my introduction to programming and computers was like, oh, firstly, you can break it, but secondly, you can fix it. And then I learned programming, quick basic, and then I learned Python. I've relearned Python, I don't know, 20 times at this point. But I've done all sorts of things from, we created the first school prospectus on a CD, like a digital version at my high school. I did Cisco's CCNA as part of a pilot program. You mentioned before that you saw I'd studied at CPIT. I condensed their 3-year networking diploma into 1 year, which they did not like. And then I went to be an admin at schools. And then I worked at telco and I got heavily into automating stuff. Funny story, Spark is their name now, but Telecom, they were doing fiber to the node. And they were like, oh, it's too expensive to automate. So I used AutoPlotKey and wrote a script to just do my job for me. And so I would come in at 8 p.m., we'd get ready, get set up, I'd load up the spreadsheet, get everything set up, and then I just hit like Control Windows R or something to run my macro. And I just sit back watching videos on my phone while it just went through, and I just check it every now and then. And I did this for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And they were like, Caleb, you never have any issues. You never have any faults. And I was like, yeah, because I follow the process. Okay, let's go. And I was like, but I really think we should automate this. No, it's too expensive. It's going to cost us $1 million. Then next week, Houghton Hogan, I think is the name of the company, huge agri company in New Zealand, massive SLA penalties, circuit goes down, doesn't come up. They end up paying $1.1 million in penalties. There was someone else that was doing it by manually that screwed up. And these things happen. They happen in marketing. Like I published ads with spelling mistakes, like the grammatical errors, especially when working with US clients because I have dyslexia. Our English is different than US English. There's all these little things. These things happen, but it's really funny. Sometimes they can work out well. Most of the time, if you make a grammatical error on an ad, it actually works out better, but not all the time.
Wow. What a crazy background. And so did they end up automating following your lead? Did they end up automating the system and automating the process?
Yeah, I got a golden handshake, come over here, and then they wrapped up that project because they run into a funding block. And then when they released more, I guess it would have been CapEx, they were able to invest in automating it. But I exited at that point. I was like, no, I'm going to go be a dad in Australia and get a job at Optus and automate my manager out of a job.
Wow. And you've been on this bandwagon of automation for a long time, but how did you ultimately decide, I want to go down the path of digital marketing, conversion rate optimization, and e-commerce? Like, what precipitated that pivot into that space?
I distinctly remember I was 18. I got out of the depression, pretty bad depression actually. And I was watching TV or something. And I was like, man, I think hate advertising. I really remember saying that. And then did the telecom thing, did the Optus thing, came over here. When I was working at Optus, I started going insane. I was doing 12-hour shifts. It was mind-numbingly boring. While working at Optus, I attended a conference for Python program, PyCon AU. And I was chatting to someone there about natural language processing and how cool it was that you could potentially program computers using natural language. I was getting heavy into NLTK and how to like actually leverage it, reading reports and creating insights and stuff like this. And I was like, what if you could do this for yourself? And I was like, oh, that's what NLP, that neuro-linguistic programming, is. And I remembered when I was one morning, I was having a go at Forex trading and the markets were like all over the place. I was like, okay, I'm not going to trade. I'm going to put it on a video. And I found this Richard Bandler video. I just zoned out and I was like, oh, okay, there's something to this. And so I was like, I might learn hypnosis. So I spent like 40, 60 grand on hypnosis, did all these trainings, certified, all, whatever. And I was living in Caboolture in Queensland. And I didn't know this at the time, but it was the lowest socioeconomic city in Australia 7 years in a row. And I decided to start a hypnosis practice there. And I knew nothing about marketing. So this failed miserably. I did markets, I did calls, I did emails, I walked around to businesses, I went to Dr. Edwards, a shit show. And so I went, okay, clearly I need to learn marketing. Who's really good at marketing? Affiliate marketers. So I looked at affiliate marketing and I was like, okay, this is interesting, but I've done door-to-door sales and I know I can't sell something that I don't believe in for more than about 6 weeks or I'm going to go insane. So I was like, okay, what if there's obviously other types of marketing and I like this digital marketing stuff. What if I found a product I believed in? And I found Cat Howell's FAT many years ago. And I was like, okay, this is really interesting. I think there's something to this. I ended up going to her first ever Hawaii mastermind, got my funnel knocked out in a day, had my first client within 2 weeks, and never really looked back. Because what I found was if you put creative copy and targeting into a media platform and you understand that there's a persona or an avatar that you're speaking to on the other side that is represented by the data you get back as in terms of feedback, then you have near real-time feedback to test your ideas. This is insane. This is like one of the best things that's ever happened in the marketing world. You get near real-time feedback to test your kooky ideas. So then I just went nuts testing everything. Like I developed a process where within a week we would test like 100 different ad variations. I started building my own reporting dashboards and stuff like this. Like I just went all in on the marketing side of it. And obviously the hypnosis training and even the programming for being able to create my own reports and this kind of stuff, it all played into that. And then I signed my first 10K client maybe 6 months after this. And I was like, I've made it, right? Which you never make it, just FYI for anyone who's listening. So many mistakes were made here. But he had a 0.7x ROAS end of the first month. We're looking at about a 1.7. End of the second month, I've got him at 2.7. And he's, this is amazing. I'm like, yeah, but it's not as good as I want it to be. Can I make some tweaks to your website? Because my ads are kicking ass. I have a 6% click-through rate. My CPA is pretty low. There's not a lot more I can optimize here. But when they hit your website, something's going wrong. And he was like, yeah, sure, I'll duplicate it. You tell me what changes you want. So we did this. We did an A-B test URL, old school. And the changes that I wanted had an uplift of something like 30%. So he went from like 2.7 to 3.6 or something ridiculous like this. His margin was like 90%. So he was like, can we increase the budget? Which is what you want from a client, right? If you're getting that result, there is no budget. It's just spend more money. And I was like, oh, this is it. And that was like 7 or 8 years ago. And I just haven't looked back. I've done thousands of tests. So I've learned a lot more about like the branding design side from my ex and my business partner in Echo. She's an amazing woman, very into that emotional side of things. So she helped me bring some of that into the data and then pair it up. And so now it's, yeah, I can absolutely guarantee like a 40% lift in 90 days. There's no reason I can't. Unless you're sitting at a 7% conversion rate, then it might be like 20% or something like that. But I've worked with companies that started at 7% and then at the end of 90 days, they were like 8.5. So again, I know I have a good grasp of what's possible. On desktop, highest conversion rate. E-commerce I've seen was 15% when I was going to short things. People say 3% is the industry benchmark, 3 to 5%. Sure, but why would you want to be the benchmark?
And so now your focus is completely on CRO, okay, conversion rate optimization. So you've got out of the marketing side of the business, and now you're focused really on what happens when traffic actually hits a given e-commerce website. Is that my understanding?
More or less. E-commerce Wizards is, it's about optimizing your business. And the way we go to market with that is, yes, you're simply a test away from ludicrous profit. And when you run people through the process, and this is very typical, you work with clients, you realize, oh, I don't necessarily work like working with clients. Why can't I just teach them? Why can't they follow instructions? Oh, maybe I should create a course. Hey, let's try that. So Mark and I, he's my business partner with E-commerce Wizards, and I joined and he signed up to something called Playful Millions, which was being run, and I just got it because I joined the column. And we got randomly paired together, air quotes, randomly paired together. I don't believe in that crap, but randomly paired together. And we do this exercise and it's great. And then a couple months later, he's like, hey, what do you actually do? And I'm like, oh, I do CRO. And he's like, I take this the wrong way, but are you any fucking good? And I was like, my win rate's about 80%. He's like, I'll send you some screenshots. So I sent him some. And he's like, why are you struggling financially? I was like, because I don't know how to market myself. I can market anyone else, fine, easy. But myself, not so easy. And he was like, all right, let's do something about this. Do you want to do something? And I was like, so long as it's fun, I'm down. And we came up with the idea for E-commerce Wizards. We ran a 14-day challenge. It didn't end up needing to take 14 days. And we had about 10 people join it. And we ran them through my process of, okay, who's your avatar? Who's your dream customer? Your basic sort of persona stuff on that. Based on that, what is wrong with your website? So I have a 10-point checklist. These are 10 conversion killers. Happy to run through that. But it's things like branding, clicks to objectives, site speed, design, CTAs. It's pretty high-level stuff, but it's how I was helped to structure the idea, structure what was in here so I can actually give it to someone in a useful way. And so I just taught them that and went through and said, look, you just use Google Optimize because that was still a thing. Damn them for getting rid of that. So free software. Here's things to test. I'll just tell you what to run because I know these five have a 90-something percent chance of working. Nothing works 100% of the time. I have seen really weird stuff. Like I have taken a website from a 27 second load speed to a 13 second load speed and the conversion rate has gone down. That makes no sense to me.
That doesn't make any sense to me either. Yeah.
But for some reason, that audience who were predominantly older had a much higher desktop to mobile ratio than typical. So our theory was they're probably used to loading a page, walking away.
Coming back, then when it's loaded, then they can browse.
But if you click and it loads and they're like in the middle of getting away, you're not interrupting them. And I used to run a Clubhouse, co-host a Clubhouse room, and I dropped a bomb one day and I was like, oh, I'm writing that down. The path to the checkout should be clear and well lit, right? Like an airplane aisle, right? Clear and well lit. So the moment you introduce friction, the moment you introduce an extra decision or you interrupt a thought process, you're introducing friction. And so that's the only theory I can come up with that one. But there's other things like payment icons is a very common one that has a fantastic lift, typically somewhere between 12 to 20% or higher. I've seen that not work 3 times. Now I'm talking 3 out of maybe 500, 600 sites that I've tested, but again, nothing works 100% of the time. Yeah, we focus a lot on that, but we also focus on, okay, for example, a lot of business owners will get in a self-sabotage cycle and they'll have no clue that they're doing that. They'll change their ads every day. They'll tweak budgets outside of safe parameters. They'll make changes to the website because they need to push a sale because revenue hasn't been good for the last 3 days. But now they've got all these factors they're not tracking. They're training their audience to wait for a sale, which is going to screw up the time period after the sale's over. And so we also step back and we go, look, the same data-driven approach can be used pretty much on every area of your business. It doesn't matter if it's customer service or if it's fulfillment. There's always opportunities for optimization. There's always something you can do to look at the data, ask the right question, which comes from having the right mindset, which is now what we're really focusing on trying to teach people. And then you unlock. And typically there's unlocks of 200 to 400% in any area. Because once you find the linchpin thing, it's just like this massive domino effect.
And how much do you start thinking about things that maybe are non-website related, but they will most definitely impact conversion? For example, out of stocks, the percentage of the catalog at any given point in time that is out of stock. Because what I've seen is that in conversion rate optimization, sometimes there's this myopic view that, hey, if I change the right button, if I change my color scheme, if I change my font, if I change this simple string of text, if I make this one tweak, that's the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And I think also sometimes it's not just the path to purchase, but it's also the information, the reassurance, the trust marks. It's because I can go. And when I look at Reddit, for example, and I'm often on Reddit and I'm trying to answer as many e-commerce related questions as I can, I'm trying to help the industry, I'm trying to help people that are my mentees, et cetera. And I see the same things every day. I see 5 to 6 posts a day posted to Reddit. People with new e-commerce websites, they spend $1,500, $2,000, $10,000, $20,000 on ads, and they haven't made a sale, or maybe they've made 1 sale or 2 sale or 3 sales. And when I go to their website, now I'm not a CRO specialist by any stretch of the imagination. But when I go to the website, I can immediately say, I would never buy through this website. First of all, there's nothing special about their products. Second of all, there's zero trust. When I go to the contact page, it's a contact us form. There's no email address. There's no phone number. There's no physical address. So I have no idea where these guys are located. The products don't necessarily look that good. The pricing isn't that fantastic. There's zero differentiation there. There's zero brand that I recognize. For all I know, it's highly likely that if I was to buy something off this website, not that I would, but even if I did, it's highly likely I'm never going to get the goods and I've just flushed my money down the toilet. And so there's no founder story. There's no nothing on the website. And I am not a CRO specialist, but I am a human being and I am a consumer. And I know just subconsciously all the things I'm looking for. And I do probably 80 to 90% of my retail shopping I do online. So I shop on a lot of websites. And the reality is that trust for me is a really big deal. And I still feel like as of 2024, trust still feels like a really big deal. And so if they're a one or two product brand, red flag. If they are on Shopify and they're running a basic out of the box theme and I see lorem ipsum text anywhere on the website, red flag. There's this list of 20 subconscious red flags that I think some of these brands, these consistent mistakes that they make over and over again, and I'm sure similar repetitive mistakes that are made over and over again, even by seemingly advanced brands that have been doing this for a long time.
Yeah, definitely. You raised several things, so let me try to address them in order. Like originally off page, yes, I do still do some private work, but I will refuse to work with anyone who doesn't have a basic idea of their personas because of just how fundamentally important that actually is to good marketing in general, and who doesn't have at least the bare bones, abandoned cart, abandoned checkout sequence, email sequence, ideally with SMS. Part of the reason for that is if you increase your conversion rate, and I'll drop this as well, I don't focus exclusively on conversion rate, and I'll loop back to that. If you increase your conversion rate, you're increasing your acquisition of new customers. Now, most people don't understand this, but if you're paying for cold traffic, you are paying for the most expensive part of the most expensive part of customer acquisition. Customer acquisition is one of the three levers that you actually have to make any sort of meaningful impact in your business. Cold traffic is the effing most expensive you can possibly pay for. And if you're not, as a business, if you're not willing to invest, like Klaviyo is sweet FA, ActiveCampaign is sweet FA, these things, if your average order value is above $50 and you don't have abandoned cart sequences, you are leaving thousands of dollars a month on the table, especially if you have more than about 10, 20,000 case sessions. You are pissing money away. Stop doing that, please. For you and your kids and your family's future, please stop doing that. So yeah, there are things like that. Branding is quite important and it's becoming more important as a culture. We shift more deeply into story and personal brand type marketing, where brand recognition is incredibly important, but where people are at in the emotional storyline, the hero's journey, these things are super, super important. And they're becoming more so because as the younger generation grows up and has money, some that's quite polarized, but as they do, you're ending up with shoppers who know how to price shop. There's so much information is available. You have to very quickly and succinctly differentiate yourself. And one of the easiest ways to do that with humans is an emotional hook. Guess what? Stories are all about emotion. Good stories. So yeah, there's a lot off site that comes into it and ends up on the site as well, right? Like it's not in isolation at all. And then you mentioned like the one thing. Yeah, there's never just one thing. I've set a multi-variant test off that I thought was absolutely going to crush it out of the gate and it's bombed. And I'm like, damn, all right, let's create another one. I'll update my model of what this particular audience cares about because clearly they don't care about those things. And that's something people also don't do when they sit down and they do CRO. Typically, they don't track. They don't track their hypothesis. They don't track the result. And they don't do like a retroactive, why on would that result make sense? And this came up in one of our group calls, and because we do mentoring as well. It came up, the question was asked, and I just stopped and think about it. And I was like, for me, it comes back to, I can't remember the exact question, otherwise it's stated. It comes back to what actual question is going to result in an answer that makes sense? Because often we ask the wrong question. That's one thing I like about your podcast is you actually flip it. You have people ask you a question. It's good. It's nice. Nice little thing. What I'll ask is, okay, what needs to be true for this result to make sense? And so I just throw out all of my preconceived notions, whatever. My opinion doesn't matter because the data is very clearly telling me you're wrong. So what needs to be true for this to be the result that I'm seeing? And then based on how you answer that, you can update your understanding of your audience. The more you know your audience, the higher the probability that everything else you do is going to be more successful. So these things, like you can do CRO just on the website, but it can end up playing into your ads. It can end up playing into your email marketing. And you can do CRO on all those things as well. So it's, again, it's not in isolation. And then, yeah, the 1, 2, 3, 10K in ads and not getting a result. I have a very simple process. I borrow it from drop shipping. If it's not working in 3 days, kill it. It's a very simple 3-day process. Either you don't know how to sell it, or it's a shit product, or it's a shit product for you, which comes back to you don't know how to sell it. Yeah, I wouldn't, if someone's sinking hundreds of dollars into a product and they're not even getting added to carts after a week, nah, stop. Take a break. Go for a surf. I do something, break state, come back and sit down and go, okay, I am the problem. Just start there and go, how do I solve this? What kind of problem? Is it a copywriting problem? Is it a graphics problem? Because that's a major thing, right? The quality of images is so important. And it's so easy these days when you have AI to get some half decent images. They're getting used a lot more. We photoshopped, we took a supplement bottle, asked ChatGPT to create a set of images that would be like emotive and promote good gut health. It came up with a bunch. We tested them in ads. There was one we really liked. I took that, I put it in Photoshop. I used Firefly to drop out the things that looked super weird. And then I just backdropped, put the product on there. We ran that and it was so hard. It took me like 3 minutes to do it. It was crazy. But versus sitting down and like getting a graphic designer and all that stuff. So I think the barriers are coming down for that kind of stuff. Really, you're in business to make a profit. If you're not making a profit, well, you're in business to serve people and hopefully in a good way. And the byproduct is the profit. If you're not serving, you're not giving value in your ads, you're not giving value in your newsletter, you're only promoting a sale, that's going to be hurting you. Go back to story, go back to purpose, go back to why, go back to founder, like you mentioned. Like founder stories are so powerful. And like letters from the CEO, such good little tools to get engagement. Yeah, and then optimize. Don't blindly follow a particular process because it worked for Alex Hormozi or Ezra Firestone. Optimize, look at what the data is actually saying and stop, ask questions, try to understand it. Try to go, okay, if this input gave me this output, what can I change as an input? And then I'll see a different output. And eventually you'll begin to go, oh, for this audience, this input gets me that result. And I like that result. Let's do more of that. And then, yeah, there's so many mistakes, man. I've worked with businesses doing millions of dollars a month and been able to double that. I've worked with 8-figure clothing brands. I've worked with no-name clothing brands. I worked with a clothing brand in the US that partnered with Underground Railroad. They donated 5% of the profits to charity. It was nowhere on their product page. Nowhere. They weren't telling anyone. It wasn't like a business reason. It wasn't that they wanted to fly that under the radar. I've worked with businesses that have decided to do that because they just want it to be their, like the owner's goodwill kind of thing. And they have it on the label, but they don't market. It's not a marketing angle for them. That's fine. But yeah, mistakes, man. It comes back to not knowing your audience and not putting the time into testing to know them better. Because that's the way I look at testing. It's a way for you to have a data-based conversation with your audience that results in you serving them better.
And how often would you want to employ additional tooling, additional dashboards, additional tools like attribution tools, Triple Whale, North Beam, better tooling that plugs in to understand your unit economics, Store Hero, Clar, etc.? How often, or even using a third-party service that you can send a survey out via these third-party services to give feedback on your website, say, oh, maybe set them some tasks. Here's a task, go and do this on the website. Can you actually even achieve the task? How often do you think it's useful for people to be bringing in other tooling other than pure maybe A/B testing tooling or things like that? How often do you think that it needs to be data informed in ways that you can't get from something like Google Analytics, etc.? Hey team, I have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening.
Yeah, that's a thing. Attribution is the bane of marketers.
across the globe. And I think it will continue to be. I'm not the first to say that.
That's why people look at business ROAS these days.
Where and what are we spending? What's the traffic coming? What's the overall ROAS? We have a private client that started out, their CPA was like $250. They've got seed capital. They're selling like completely organic, first of its kind in the world, electrolyte drink. And they were like, oh, we're getting sales from Google ads. Let's turn off Meta. So they turned off Meta, sales plummeted. But attribution wise, they weren't getting any sales from Meta. So what the hell is going on there? It's recognition. It's all these other ephemeral things that are ludicrously difficult to track. Now, yeah, if you install Triple Whale or Hyros or something like that, it gets a lot easier. I think it depends on what stage you're at. Mark has this really good model that you're always in one of four stages and you can be in more than one stage at once. So you're either testing, which is basically you have an idea and you're trying to prove or disprove that idea. You're scaling, which basically means you're trying to break it. So think, okay, I've dialed in my ads and my website's converting at 4%. Great. Let's increase the budget on the ads. Cool. Your fulfillment's about to die. Just that's the most likely next thing to break. So you walk through the sequences and you just find what's the next thing that I'm going to need to fix. And so I think tools can be incredibly useful. But yeah, so you could be testing with ads, you could be testing with your email, but at the same time, you could be scaling your customer service, for example. And what's really cool is I scaled a business, or it was part of the team that scaled a business. So I take full responsibility for that. I was part of the team that scaled a business from 0 to 7 figures in 90 days, which I would never recommend for so many different reasons, especially a physical product that you are trying to manufacture in-house. So as part of that, obviously it's very easy to scale ads. When you dial it in, you increase budget. Customer service, once you develop the process, you can scale by onboarding staff, or now you're using AI, very helpful for that as well. But physical production is like this whole other beast that people don't necessarily understand. You had a really good conversation the other day with someone talking about supply chain. Fulfillment is its own, and it can be as simple as you just get a container load, and so long as you plan, that's fine. But the reality is always different. There's always something that happens. Fulfillment can break with just one little thing not going right. Oh, we don't have the steel that we need and the shipment's 3 days away. Cool. All of the orders you get between now and then have an extra 3 day minimum added to their fulfillment, if not double that, because you have the backlog.
And now all of a sudden, this requires some extra custom communication to the clients, and hopefully they don't cancel their orders. And now when you're scaling, because now let's say you've taken 1,000 orders in that window of time because you were heavily promoting via ads and you were getting the traffic, they were converting well. And now all of a sudden you've got to have 1,000 communications minimum. And
yep.
The problem is that each one of those may require a different bespoke response on the backside of that mass communication.
They may. And at the very least, if you actually care about your customers and you want to do right by the business long term, you have to at least listen to them and make them feel heard. Which, unfortunately, AI is not quite there yet. But even if it was, people won't do that all the time unless there's something.
No one likes to feel like a number. No one likes to feel like a number.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. So like one of our members, she was really struggling, and then she found a new product because she's in fashion. She'll find new products and stuff, and she dropped it using what we'd taught her and that kind of thing, and it took off. So we just walked her through the process of scaling that, and the manufacturer sold out. And the manufacturer turned around and went, I don't know what you're doing, but I've never had anyone sell out of something we just started producing that quickly. What do you want to do? And she was like, I want you to make more, please.
Wow.
And now she's spending so much time fulfilling that she's not working on these others. We're just like going, okay, look, A, hand this over to friends, family, staff, like whatever you have to. Your genius zone is not in packaging dresses. You can pay a child to do that. Not that I'm saying use child labor. It's just, I was a kid. My mom was a real estate agent. I licked stamped envelopes. Like it's my frame, right? So I think tools can be really helpful for predicting these things. I think they can be really helpful for retroactive analysis, which I don't think enough businesses do, especially year to year. So we tell people, start planning your Black Friday now. And if you do it, your Black Friday will set you up for your Christmas, Boxing Day, which will set the new baseline for next year. And a lot of marketers that I listen to don't think about it that way. They look at Q4 as a cash injection, and a lot of businesses will enjoy that cash injection. They may even make the majority of their revenue from that cash injection, but they don't use it as a platform to start the next year, like reset with a baseline that's high. And I don't know why, because to me, that just made sense out of the gates. You've just spent all this time, energy, money, planning, investing in this effing big promo that's going to last for now a month because people were doing pre-Black Friday.
Post, first, yeah.
And then post, which is good in the sense that you get more out of your assets. But the same thing still applies. You spend 6 months planning for a 1 month promotion, and then you turn around and what do you do with those people? If you don't have the right nurture sequence, if you don't reset expectations that you don't do a sale all the effing time, then they're going to drop. They're not going to come back and buy until Black Friday next year. And then you're going to have to win them back again because you haven't spoken to them because they fell into disengaged. So your newsletters haven't been going to them. Most people don't have a re-engagement campaign set up. So there's all these little parts that to optimize in the business. And I think tools can be really helpful for that. Things like Lifetimely. There are a couple of others like this. If you have a specific
Wicked Reports, or there's probably 20 major. And then there's marketing mix modeling platform, measurement platforms out there too. So that in the scenario where you were talking about where this brand said, according to our attribution software, we're getting everything, almost all of our revenue is coming from our Google ads. We don't think Meta ads are driving much performance. So let's drop that. Oh my gosh. Probably marketing mix modeling technology would have told them that probably wasn't a good idea, or at least the moment that they turned it off within 24 hours, the marketing mix modeling platform would have probably said, this actually contributed X number of dollars to your incremental revenue. So therefore you better turn it back on again. And so I think, I guess what I'm trying to say is that where oftentimes brands had to do everything in very complex spreadsheets, now there is relatively inexpensive technology that can plug into their e-commerce website, can plug into their ERP, can plug into their fulfillment systems and pull data, and even pull in data from the marketing platforms, pull in data from Google, pull in data from Meta, pull in data from Amazon, and start to crunch the numbers for you at scale so that you can see where your incremental revenue, where your incremental profitability, where your best ad spend is going. So it feels like this now, it's probably we went from a place where there was no technology to help, to where now there's almost too much technology to help, and brands don't even know which technology to select because they're going, okay, do I need to implement a CDP? Do I need to implement attribution software? Do I need to implement custom analytics software? Do I need to have some custom dashboards created for me? So I guess from a CRO perspective, when you get to brands and you're maybe starting to work with them for the very first time, and they've got all the tech, they've got all the whiz bang, wow, everything, but yet they still don't know what to do next, or they don't even know what hypothesis to put together for a conversion rate optimization test. It's like they've got all the gear and no clue. That's a saying, somebody with all the gear, but no clue. And we say that in the motorcycle world. I'm a motorcycle rider, and you see them with all the flash gear and they've got the Alpenstars, everything, and they've got the modern flash bike, but they can't ride and they're terrified of their motorcycle. And you can see, and we say they've got all the gear and no clue. And we can say that in the e-commerce world too. Somebody's got all the tech and they spend $20,000 a month on technology, but they behave like a deer in the headlights because they're almost too overwhelmed with data. They're almost too overwhelmed with opportunities. So how do you get in there and strip it all back to its most basic elements to say, let's start moving one lever at a time so that we know when we make a change, that whether it's an impactful or not? Because if you go and you change everything all at once, you don't really know what had the impact, right?
100%. And that's the worst. Because then it's like, oh, we did these things and it got better, but then it got worse. Which is very common because there's something called the novelty factor. And it's a real thing in conversion rate testing. That's why you need to wait at least 10, if not 14 days. Because you make a random change on your website, and in some audiences, the fact that the website's changed will result in a bump in conversion rate. Now, if you're not tracking your AOV, your revenue per session, which is really important revenue per user or unique depending on the software, and you've made 15 changes, you have no clue. No clue. I just want to loop back and I'll answer this. I need to build a frame because it's a really good question. I haven't been asked it before. The growth quadrants were testing, proving, growing, and scaling. So you go through this cycle, and for whatever you're in, there's like some metric that's going to be your North Star. And based on whatever you're in, you're just watching that to make sure it's within acceptable bounds. When it falls out, you're going to go back to testing, basically. So you always revert back to testing when you get an anomaly, because now you need to come up with a hypothesis and then validate. So I just want to close that loop. Going to the let's use Amart Furniture. They were a really good example of this. Big national furniture store here in Australia, $2 million a month online revenue. AOV is like $700, $750, something like that, right? Magento, massive platform, lot of back end, lot of guys sitting there crunching numbers. All right, let's take part in this mobile optimization thing. Let's see what's going on here. All right, your conversion rate, 0.07%. And they're doing $2 million, right? So what do I do? One of the first things I do is I assume I know nothing. And I really put that hypnosis and the passion for psychology. And to be clear, I never studied psychology. Like, I've gone through a couple of MIT's online psych 101 type stuff. I'm heavily into personal development, have been since I was about 7 years old. I have some practical application, but I would not say I'm skilled in it per se. But I put that hat on. Okay, I'm in the market for furniture. I want a new bed frame and I want a bunk for my daughters. Sit down, incognito window, bring it up on my mobile. Let's just walk through the buying process. Where do I get pissed off? What do I like? What don't I like? Cool. Now, let's go and look at heat maps. If they've got all the tech, they should have heat maps. How deep are people getting on the page? Most people don't know. Most people visiting your site, being over 50%, don't see your footer. They don't even see your bloody reviews, because if you've got a decent sized product description, they're not scrolling that far. It's just numbers, right? Like, at the end of the day. And then, okay, now let's look at some actual recordings. Recordings are incredibly useful, and a lot of people don't know what to do with them. When you sit down from this point of view of, I am the business's customer, I don't know how to use the website, I don't know if I can trust the business, and you go through the experience and then you watch video recordings, the penny drops real quick. You go, it looks like they can't find the information they're looking for. Well, why does it look that way? The mouse is going over here and then they're doing a quick scroll down and then they're scrolling back up and then they're clicking very quickly between things. So they're clearly looking for something. They're skimming. Why would I skim? I would skim if I was seeing key points jumping out at me. That's why I'm going to skim something. I want to get a gist of something, right? So there's an unanswered question and I'm trying to find the answer on the page. What are FAQs? Okay. Is that on the product page? Let's start there as a hypothesis. Let's test that out. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Typically, that's a good one to do, but not all the time. And not always on every type of product that you have on your website, which is another weird thing about audiences. Sometimes a particular type of product doesn't need the FAQ, but a different one absolutely needs the FAQ. So I try and come in as like this detective, this like super curious kid almost, of like
intentionally naive, right?
Yes. Yeah. I want to be stupid. I want to be deliberately dumb and treat this like I don't know how to buy something online. What scares me? Are there reviews? Yes. How many reviews? 5. Are they all 5 stars? Yes. Okay. That's a little concerning. Let's test hiding those. Let's wait until you've got 11, 12, 13, 14, 17 reviews before we show them. I don't know why. I've tested this again and again and again. It's not 100%, but most of the time, if you've got less than double digits in reviews, showing them is actually harming your conversion rate. Not all the time, but a lot of the time, because there's not enough social proof. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. You could have, it's like when you go and you see a sign, it's only 5-star reviews, and show some 1s and 2s. Otherwise, it's like, what's going on?
I just assume, as a human being, I just assume they've hidden all of the 1 and 2 star reviews, or the five-star reviews or the five-star reviews are made up and they wrote them internally.
Which is a problem.
Yeah. So that's, I think that's pretty normal human psychology. When I see, mostly fives, a couple of fours, maybe a two, maybe a one, then I'm like, okay, as long as the ones and twos don't outweigh the fours and the fives, then the product is probably pretty good.
Yeah. And then you go and you look and you see the ones and twos, which you can do if they're actually showing them. And half the time people are complaining about,
I took them 2 weeks to get it to me or something.
Yeah. Something that has nothing to do with the quality of the product.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. I come in with that deliberately naive, childlike, let's just look at this as though we don't have any assumptions about the business frame. And I'll ask really difficult questions because I'm coming from that frame. So I'll sit down with the 8-figure business and I'll be like, okay, who are your personas? And they're like, we did this branding thing 3 years ago and they gave us this 42-page PowerPoint presentation and we've got about 5 points on each persona. But I don't know if it's really relevant because we recently did a post-purchase survey and apparently 40% of the people who buy from us are in their 50s and we didn't have any persona that was in their 50s. Cool. Let's start there.
Yeah. Let's start with actual data as opposed to theoretical data. And I think that this gets back to your point, which is that there's a lot of things we need to think about beyond just A/B testing a page or A/B testing a color or a function or a piece of information. We actually need to understand our customers. And if a brand is more than, say, a year old, has any kind of decent traffic whatsoever, has any decent amount of sales whatsoever, we now have a real customer cohort. We have a legit customers that have already bought off us to be able to go. And instead of creating theoretical cohorts, we can create real cohorts of customers. And we can understand those customers quite intimately. And then all of a sudden now, and I think this needs to be revisited probably a minimum of every 6 months, because the reality is our demographic changes over time. We found that even at HealthPost, we found that our target demographics, our target profiles of the customers that were our normal customers, they changed over time. As the brands we carried changed, as the product ranges we changed, as the additional product content changed, when we implemented a PIM and we were able to give much more detailed attributes around products so that we could add facets and filters to categories, our demographic changed slightly. So with every major business change that we made, we would find that our major buying demographic would change slightly. And so therefore, now all of a sudden, we needed to revisit that pretty regularly to make sure that new target avatar was getting everything they needed through our web experience. But if you only do it once every 5 years, because you assume that your customer base has stayed the same, then you're missing out on an opportunity to tailor that experience over time to be more tightly aligned with the types of customers that you're already attracting.
Yeah, and you're also leaving a shit ton of money on the table, because not only do customer avatars change, but your business can grow to adopt that. And while you're doing this research, it's actually a revenue opportunity. So we did in Echo, we used to do a 6-week email cleanse is the word we use. We would go through and would basically take the entire email list. Obviously, I would recommend if you want to do this now with the Google changes that, but prior to Google and Yahoo screwing this up, it worked really well. Take the entire list. And you do something like 20-ish emails over a 6-week period. You stagger them according to two different sales and you poll. And so you're getting actual qualitative and quantitative data, because your quantitatives are, what are the actions people actually take? Because, oh yeah, I would take part in this kind of sale, or I prefer being emailed this often. Yeah, but how often do you actually open the email? So you want both. And so by polling and by engaging with your audience, and you can incentivize them. And I will say this, whenever you incentivize anything in a business and in life to some degree, you are creating an opportunity to exclude certain people who otherwise would engage, and inviting people who self-select. So even if you have 100K people on your list, you send an email out and you say, we're going to give $10 off, fill out the survey and 100,000 people sign up. First of all, that's not going to happen. In reality, if you got 100K list, you might get 10K people.
That's great. You've got a lot of data that you can mine out of that. That is not an accurate representation that allows you to make assumptions for the entirety of your email list. It can be a good indicator. And if you've got a tool like Klaviyo that lets you look at behavioral metrics, then you might be able to generalize more of that. If you've got a really good system where you're pulling in like on-site behavior, purchasing behavior, email opens into just like a sheer data table, and then you want to run some ML stuff on that, yeah, then you can make some generalized guesses because you can do functional dimension reduction, right? So you can figure out correlations between people, reduce the dimensions, and that'll let you make an informed decision based on actual data science. But you're always going to have some element of unknowns. So yeah, I think asking the actual question, okay, we've been in business for a year, let's ask our audience and let's say thank you. Give them a reason to come back and buy more while you're doing it. Why not? Otherwise, you're going to miss out on money. Okay, turns out our audience has changed. Okay, are we still hitting that old audience on socials, on our paid media? Yeah, it turns out we are. Okay, so that actually means we now have two audiences, not one. All right, cool. How do we serve both? You're not just looking at one audience now. You've just doubled the potential market by asking a bunch of bloody questions. If you're not doing it, you're missing out.
Leaving money on the table. And I think you raise a good point, which is to measure the gap between what customers say they want or will do and what they actually do on the backside of that, and trying to close that gap and say, why is there a gap? Why is there a gap between what my customers are saying they want us to be and do for them and the behavior that they take when we do those things? And if those two are not aligned, then we need to base this probably on the actual thing that they're doing when we do a certain behavior as a business and say, look, we can close this gap by just making sure that we're doing all the things that subconsciously incentivize all of the customer behaviors we want them to take. So I feel like this is, and I honestly think this is where CDPs start to really come into their own over and above a traditional marketing automation platform, which can start to connect a whole bunch of behavioral data across multiple channels, both sales and marketing channels, and bring those in as unique profile properties that then allow us to segment in ways we can't do in a traditional marketing automation platform, with maybe where we can only have Boolean values as customer profile properties, for example. And so I feel like this is starting to get into an area where AI now allows us to identify behavioral trends within our customer cohorts that a human being, we wouldn't be able to connect those dots, but AI can, and it can create correlations in ways that we would never normally see. And it's because it's able to digest data at scale in ways that we can't as human beings, that allows us to make decisions quick. Once we're presented with this empirical data, then it allows us to act with more confidence and to do it a lot faster. That's what I think the promise of AI is. And are you seeing AI and machine learning starting to creep ever more incessantly into the CRO and data analysis space?
Yeah, so I have a little story that actually really highlights the point you're making. So while I was at Food Matters, they were so adamant about who the audience was. Karen, 55-year-old woman concerned about her partner's prostate cancer. Cool. She doesn't buy. That was their biggest problem. Our audience doesn't buy. I heard that every week in the office, which just culturally is a really bad thing to do to your business. Like, we haven't touched on any of the esoteric stuff or the mindset yet, but the energy you as a business owner put into your business has a measurable effect. And I'm getting into the point where I'm starting to do some interesting stuff testing wise, embedding things like sacred geometry and having congruent and incongruent messages and seeing a measurable difference in the results. And there's so much science about that stuff now. So first of all, you want to, as a business owner, try and have an open mind that, like, yes, it's your baby, it's your business, but you don't know everything, because if you did, you would be where you want to be already. Just start there, be humble. And then I looked at the stats, and this is another thing that a lot of people don't do because it takes time, it's difficult, and they don't know how to do it. And AI is really bridging that particular gap, because you can get an app, you can plug it in, you can ask your questions, and it'll go through the data, figure it out for you. But so I manually did this back in the GA3 days and, or Universal Analytics. And sorry, 28% of your audience is Caro. You're alienating 75% of your audience because you're only putting content out that speaks to Caro and she doesn't buy. So this is why your sales are shit. And I've seen that time and time again when I've done an audit for a business or something like that. I'll go and I'll look and I'll say, okay, your ads are saying this. I get to the website saying something different. And then when I ask you what you do, that's nowhere at all in the website or in your ads. There's no consistency here. It's like Cloud Cuckoo Land. No consistency.
Yeah, there's some really good companies coming up that are taking things like ads and giving recommendations. And I think a lot of it's going to come from recommendations. I beta tested Action Insights, I think is their name. You can throw a URL in there. You don't even throw a URL. You can take a Photoshop design or whatever your graphic designer uses. You can do a screen scroll, not just a screenshot, do a full scroll and plug that in. And it using their ML, it'll give you to about 95-98% accuracy heat map before you even go to market.
That's crazy.
Things like that, I think, is super, super useful. Because when you think about, okay, something, the quote I said earlier, the path to the checkout should be clear and well lit. Cool. So if I'm looking at a cart page, which you may not even need, if I'm looking at a cart page and we have the standard nav menu, there's probably like 17 bloody call to actions there. And then you've got your footer, which is, if no one's edited it, it's probably another 12. And then you've got these buttons, which may not be optimized. And it's okay, let's redesign this. But before you even need to roll that page out, you can test different versions and get a statistically significant probability that this one's going to do well. So you might narrow it down to take two versions and then do a multivariant or a split test between those three versions. So I think it's the tech is shortcutting things. Like you can take if you have a well-written customer persona and you put that in ChatGPT and then you say, this is my persona. And I want to make my product page better for them. Can you give me some suggestions? A lot of people will be surprised at the kind of results that will come out. So I encourage everyone to do that. I'm not going to speak to it because I want people to take action because then they'll see for themselves. And when you see for yourself, you might actually take some more action. And then you'll get a result and that'll be a good thing. But yeah, they're reducing barriers. We had the information age, right? That was power comes through knowledge gaps. Effectively. And now we're in this place where with a 7 billion parameter thing that you can run on your phone, you have Wikipedia and Reddit in a way that you can talk to for a lot of general, but still accurate human information. I don't think people understand like how much that is going to change existence, for lack of a better word. And then if you want to apply that to any particular niche, like CRO, sure. I think where we're heading is very much, and this is something I have my eyes on and would love to develop out, and Wizards, we have it on the board of things to do, is a software that basically audits the site for you, looks at, so our Keystone product was 72 tests that I've run. They're like the most likely to give you a result. Most of them have a lift of something like 10 to 18%, something like that. So if you just systematically work through those, it would change your business. But if you've got that, that's data, and then you can audit the website, which you've got SEO reports that are automated these days anyway. Machine learning can inspect the page, read the structured data, and then you can throw the images into Midjourney, for lack of a better example, and say, give me a description for this. It's pretty accurate these days. Or you could use YOLO 7 if you wanted to go down that road. But I'm just saying there's many different ways that you could plug this together. And then you could go, okay, based on this particular PDP, product description page, I recommend these three tests, click the button, let's run them, right? And it just goes. And I think that's where we're heading. And the reason I think that's where we're heading is I had a fantastic chat with a woman many years ago that worked at 3G Xerox, and they were basically developing this then.
And look, this has just been so fascinating. Again, this is all talking about stuff that I'm not an expert in by any stretch of the imagination. But I'm wondering, as we come down to the close of our time together, when do you think I'll be able to speak to a website and have a dialogue with a website? When do you think I'll be able to go to a website and I'll be able to say, hey, look, I'm looking for a gift for my sister. She's turning 46. She is into XYZ interests, and I want to stay under a budget of $100. And can you recommend some things to me that you think would be a good fit for her? Or this type of conversational AI, because I think, you know, we call it conversational AI, but it's not. It's question and answer AI today. It's not conversational. Like, you and I are having a conversation. We're having a stream of thought conversation where I'm taking feedback from you. I'm internalizing that. I'm synthesizing that. And then I'm formulating new questions based on what you said and vice versa. That is not what is happening with the likes of ChatGPT today. It is a Q&A. It's basically a supercharged search engine backed with a large language model. When do you think we're going to get to a place where we can converse with our software instead of treat it like a Q&A machine?
So I have two thoughts on this. The first one is that we won't, and I'll dive into that after I explain the second one. The second one is that it'll be a blip. So if you think about the way technology is adopted, often the long-term adoption and implementation is not seen in the short term. Very frequently, when a radically new technology comes on the scene, it's very difficult for humans to project, to map forwards accurately what the implication of this is. So this whole conversational thing, this has been a talking piece for the last 3 years. When are we going to talk to, and just, it's, I'm having a conversation with, whether it's a website or Alexa or Google or Siri or whatever, like I'm having a conversation with you. And at the end of it, I get my shopping list done and a movie planned for tonight and the dinner reservation, so I don't have to call her, blah, 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 right? So VA, PA, EA, that's not a website. So I think what's going to happen is we're going to end up with true virtual assistants in the sense that it's not someone in the Philippines, it's an AI, and you're going to open said app on your phone, or it's just going to be your phone or some other sort of device. And you'll be like, oh, I just remembered I need to go shopping for my sister. Hey, blah, here's my criteria. And it's going to do what Google is already starting to do, where it's going to find the highest rated products that meet that criteria. It's going to scan 30,000 websites that have them, find the one with the highest rating, the quickest shipping time that most closely matches. And then depending on the settings you've set up, it's either going to make the purchase for you, or it's going to say, here's it added to your cart, click approve. Or something to that effect.
Or here's five items for you to have a further look at or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. I think the speaking to a website thing is a novel concept that will die.
I think there will be
exceptions for non-e-commerce websites. But if you think about commerce, everything to do with commerce is about reduction of friction. So if you look at very high echelons, like people who go on boards for multi-million dollar startups and stuff like that, it's a conversation and a handshake. They don't even talk about the money. I'm interested in that product. I'm happy to be on the board. And then it might be what's the cut? And it's 2%. Okay, cool. That's not in any way the experience of modern e-commerce. And even modern e-commerce, if you look at retail, it's fundamentally different. It's a different paradigm. And you had another guest that did a really good example speaking about that. It was like the shift, right, of training. I think it was in the furniture industry. Training people to buy online. Like PayPal, if you accept PayPal and you don't show the PayPal icon near your cart button, you're missing out on average, about 14% increase in conversion rate, statistically. Just saying. Right?
Wow.
Because PayPal has built so much trust in the industry for consumers that simply having it there, regardless of whether people check out using PayPal, but you accept it as a payment method, it makes a difference.
It's a trust mark in its own right. It's a trusted brand in its own right.
Yeah, 100%. But I think the same thing's going to happen with AI. There's going to be a fundamental shift in the way we do e-commerce. There will still be people that like to browse online. There will be people that want to use AR apps so they can visualize and they can look in the mirror or they can do the lipstick, whatever. I think that'll be a thing. And through that, you'll have a conversation. I don't like this color, give me a different one. That's where I think that might happen. But again, is this on a site or is this something like Shop, where you're now speaking to Shop app
And, yeah.
And it's showing you 13 different dresses that you can try on, right? Like,
or I just recorded an episode with Locally. It's about to drop in a couple of weeks' time. And they're basically bringing local commerce to the internet, where they're taking product feeds from all the retailers and all their locations. So they know exactly what inventory is there. And if I want to go and pick it up today, instead of having to go to those individual websites and see whether they offer click and collect and everything, it's all aggregated right there. So it's effectively a marketplace of click and collect options for a given product. And so this is, I think the aggregator model is ultimately going to win out, because it's the convenience factor of not having to go to individual websites that's winning out. And that's why the Amazons of the world, that's why, you know, and we can think of AI as an aggregator, because AI is aggregating the work via an agent that's going out there and doing all the legwork, the virtual legwork on our behalf, to go out there and scrape the websites and scour them and look for them and effectively do all the things we would do manually by having 15 tabs open side by side and comparing prices and comparing inventory and comparing shipping rates and shipping times and all that sort of stuff, which we do nowadays. Because price discovery, availability, and all that stuff, discovery is easy through the internet, but it still takes us as humans a lot of time to do that, unless we're just looking at Google Shopping, for example, which has made an effort to start to bring that information together. But it feels like those AI agents are going to almost completely eliminate the individual website experiences over time.
Yeah, they may. I don't know. I don't want to make a prediction on that. I think there's people, I was so pro AI, so like post-human cybernetic, yeah, that's going to chip in the brain. And then as I've developed spiritually and emotionally, I'm like, no, I don't know. I support local is definitely a thing. Maybe it's a transitional thing. Maybe it's a permanent thing. I don't know. Even in that situation, though, I see that being exactly what you're talking about. Was aggregation of local. Okay, you're someone who likes local. Here's the app that lets you buy locally.
Yeah.
And you speak to it. Well, then it...
And it removes all the friction from that local purchasing option.
Yeah. And if the AI knows everything about you, which big tech does these days, it's going to know how to recommend for you.
Listen, Caleb, look, we could go down the rabbit hole of AI and I could talk about this for the next 5 hours. That would be an easy one. And I'm sure... Look, we'll have more opportunities to have these types of conversations, but I really appreciate your time. I realize we really just went down a few little rabbit holes and we went pretty shallow, but there's a lot more to this. But I think if I had to boil down what you say into a nutshell, and if I had to boil down the many years of learnings that you've had in our space, it really comes down to empathy. Like that feels like the core character trait that we better develop as human beings, as business people, as friends, as humans. Like we just have to more find, like when you were describing kind of all the steps you go through, all the things you think of, all the tests you run, the channels that you run them across, how you run them. Like if I boiled all that down, it really comes down to just like having empathy for the type of customer that is usually going to arrive on our website, what it is they're trying to do when they get there, and trying to help them achieve those goals in the most seamless, easy, painless way possible. And that feels like it just requires some empathy. It feels like it requires us to think about what we're doing through fresh eyes in ways that maybe we have become desensitized to. Because when we work in a business for a long time, and it's the same with our computer system, it's the same with even this app, this Riverside app, for example, when I first opened it up for the very first time, I was like, holy hell, there's a lot of knobs to press here to get this thing to up and running. But once you've done it a couple of times, then you become desensitized to it. And you have your process, and I've documented my process, and here's the 15 steps I go through to get a good result for a podcast. Then I become desensitized to some of the complexities in the UI. And if Riverside was smart, I think they would be bringing in people regularly who have never played with the software before and give them a task and say, go do this. They would realize that some of the elements in the UI are not that user-friendly. Like you have to figure them out. And I'm pretty bloody tech savvy and I still had to figure them out. And so what happens if someone tries to use the software who isn't tech savvy? And I'm just using this as an example. We have people coming to our websites, and it could be a significant cohort of the people coming to our websites who are not tech savvy. They are not. We assume that just because they want to do online shopping, just because they want to come to our e-commerce website and make purchase, we assume they're tech savvy. Because why would someone who's not tech savvy even come to our website in the first place. But sometimes it's out of circumstance, or it's sometimes, hey, it's last minute, I need to make this purchase, or hey, it's during COVID and all the physical stores are closed, so now we had to come to your website whether we wanted to or not. Like, I'll get down off my soapbox now for a minute, but to me, like, it just sounds like what you are saying is we better hone our empathy skills. If we want to have the best business performance possible, we better get real empathetic real quick.
Yeah. I've been a user acceptance tester for a number of different pieces of software, and they hate me. They hate me because I would be better off as an alpha or a beta tester, because I find everything that's broken. You give me a website to look at, I will find the one product page that's broken, and I'll do it within 30 seconds or something ridiculous. It's something that has become innate in me. I think empathy is a really good way to describe it. The other way I would look at it is what you were getting at about you becoming desensitized. There's this concept called highway hypnosis, where you're just driving down the highway and all of a sudden you've missed your turn off and you go, oh, that's interesting. You weren't consciously paying attention, which is terrifying when it happens and you realize that's what happened, but it happens to a lot of us. And that happens in many areas in our life, because what's happening is our unconscious or our subconscious is running a program. So once you've established that program, for an efficiency sake, the default mode network takes over and it just runs that loop. And when that happens in business, you can become blind to a lot of things such as empathy or anything that's not profit or whatever the case may be. When you make certain things conscious, it forces you to make other things conscious, which allows you to see things you never saw before. So I would say if you have empathy, or if you build empathy, and Gary Vee is a massive proponent for empathy, so I have no issues with you saying that. I agree. If you do that and you make your business conscious at regular intervals, and I'd say quarterly, because there are tests that you can run during BFCM Q4 that will do amazingly well, and you don't want to run them the rest of the year. You don't. You want to have a different theme for your website. But if you're only testing every now and then, every 6 months or something like that, it's not enough. So every quarter at bare minimum, but I say monthly, if you've got the traffic, you can run a test every 14 days. And if you have empathy, you come at it with everything that you just summarized, then let's say you have a 60% winner. The industry average is like 30 or 40%, something like that. Let's say you only have 60%. That means every month, on average, you have one winning experiment, which means if you get a minimum, let's lowball it, 5% left. That means in the year, you're looking at over a 50% lift, because it compounds. And that's just the website. That's not you doing the same thing with your email, your SMS, your marketing, your customer service, your post-purchase.
Everything in the business. Listen, Caleb, this has been absolutely fascinating. It's challenged some of my thinking. I'm sure it's going to challenge some of my audience's thinking. I really appreciate it. I will put your LinkedIn profile link in the show notes, as I will your website. Other than that, how do you like people to get a hold of you?
I'm pretty chatty through Messenger on Facebook. So long as someone tells me where they come from, because I do get a lot of, I call them tacos, hot dogs, that kind of thing, but random stuff. But yeah, just Messenger is probably the easiest way. So if you want to have a conversation, or ecommercewizards.club, that's the site. And I have a little, if you're cool with it, we're doing another challenge. It's completely free. If anyone has at least 10,000 sessions a month in traffic, and I would say spending at least probably 5,000 on ads would be ideal, because you want to have the traffic volume and the AOV to start with and that kind of stuff. It's completely free. It's a challenge to double your Shopify revenue in 7 days. Now, I will say you're not likely to double your revenue in the 7 days, but if you simply implement the process we teach you, you will have an experiment live that's likely to win, and you will have another couple ready to go, so that you can double it just from doing that 7-day challenge.
Wow. Wow. Amazing.
And that's a link. There's a link on the website for that, and it's completely free.
I'll put that in the show notes as well. I really appreciate it. Now we're coming down to the end, and you know what's coming next, which is I'm going to turn the microphone over to you, let you ask me one question, any question you like, can be personal or professional. So Caleb Ufton from eCommerce Wizards, what is your question for me today?
Well, I want to do something a little bit different. You've had people asking really good questions. I'm actually curious, is there, or what is a question you wish someone would ask you, and what would the answer be?
Wow, that's a great question too. I love that. I love that. Look, I like to think of myself as a pretty deep person, and I really am trying to look after all the facets of my life. I've found that as I get older, balance is more important than ever before. And I think of it through the spiritual lens, the physical lens, the mental lens, the emotional lens, the family, the friends, the exercise, the body. There's a lot of things that I guess a key question that people oftentimes don't necessarily ask is, what did you maybe believe when you were young that maybe now you don't believe because you've learned something new that's replaced that belief system with age and experience and the school of hard knocks? And so I would say that, so I was raised in a very religious Christian, strong Christian family. That's how I was raised. And so I was raised with a really strong sense of morality. I was raised with a really strong sense of black and white and wrong, no gray. And my answer to that, I guess, would be that I have discovered more gray, that life is often lived in the gray, and that life is just not as much as we would like it to be. Hey, there's right and there's wrong. There's black and there's white. And I'm not saying that truth is subjective. I'm not saying that. I think there is objective truth in the world in most situations. But I just think that in order for us to be able to connect with other human beings that are different to ourselves, and this has been borne out through my travels, because I've traveled a lot around this world. My wife's Asian, and I've got friends from every race, creed, color under the sun. And the more that I expand my thinking and my suite of experiences, the more I realize life is just, it is lived in the gray. And it is just, it's just have to really, in order to develop empathy, we have to be able to see the world through other people's eyes. And I think that, and that has been borne out as I travel, as I live in other countries to where I was raised, as I live in other cities and towns to what I was raised, and with a different circle of friends to what I was raised with. You know, it's really difficult to understand why someone thinks the way they think until you go into their environment, until you go into their home, until you go into their church or their synagogue or their whatever, until you go into their circle of friends, into their local pub or their local community center. It's just, it's so hard to understand why someone thinks the way they think until, and I know this saying sounds so trite, but until you walk a mile in their shoes, it is so damn difficult. Even if you think you're an empathetic soul and that you're an empath, it is still very difficult to truly understand someone until you live at least a little while in their life and around them and near them. And all of a sudden, when you do that, it all starts to make sense. It's like, now I understand why you think the way you think and why you believe what you believe. And this is objectively truth to you. This is objectively your reality, your lived reality. They say perception is reality. No, this is your lived reality. And I understand why you live, maybe why you're introverted or extroverted or whatever it is. And when you grow up with someone, and I'm still friends with some of the people that I grew up next to, one of my next door neighbors that I was 5 and he was 4 years old, we're still good friends to this day. He understands me so well because we grew up in the same time frame, in the same environment, riding BMXs together. And it's just, I found that a lot of the things I held to be absolute undeniable truth when I was younger, now there I have question marks. Let's put it this way. I know less today about life than I did when I was 10, 12, 15 years old. I should know more, but I actually know less. And I realize that I know less. And so therefore, it has brought a level of humility to me. So people oftentimes think, you know, I'm really extroverted and I'm outgoing and I'm super confident, and I am, but there's an underlying humility there that has taken over. The more that I travel and the more that I get exposed to different people from different backgrounds, to me, the more humble I become, because all the shit that I thought I knew for sure, a lot of it was just wrong. A lot of it was just wrong. So I know that was a long-winded answer.
I know it's a great answer. I was slapped in the face with a really good quote when I lived in Christchurch, actually. I thought I knew, but I merely believed. And I've held on to that because what you just said, man, amen. I wish I could tell that to my younger self. Great answer.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Listen, brother, this has been a fantastic conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed myself, and I can't wait for us to do it again soon. I'm sure the audience will get as much out of this as I did, and I really appreciate your time, my friend. If you'd like to get mentored by Jason for free, head over to greenwoodconsulting.net, scroll to the bottom of the page, and click Get Mentored by Jason.